Today is Thursday, September 9th, 2021. This is part 5 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview series with Jim Williams. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
Good afternoon. I'm fine.
Great. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Great. Thank you. We left off at the end of part 4. You'd been working for the United States Fish and Wildlife Service in their Endangered Species Office. And I wondered about some of the more controversial, if not the most controversial, issues that you dealt with regarding a species. Can you tell me some about that?
Yeah, that the most, by far the most controversial case, for lack of a better word, that I dealt with in my tenure in the Endangered Species Office was the snail darter listing. And that started very soon after I got there. The snail darter is a small member of the perch family, and it's basically a small fish that lives on the bottom. In this case, as the common name might suggest, it's a snail eater.
Okay.
So it feeds on small snails. And this thing was discovered in, I think, 1973 or late 72 by a grad student at the University of Tennessee. And, of course, they brought it to the attention of TVA. And TVA said, oh, we aren't worried about that because they're everywhere. And then the Endangered Species Act was passed in December 73 and really got cranking in 74. And by the time I got to the office in 1974, they were already talking about this thing's endangered. It should be listed.
Hmm.
And the first problem was it had never been described. It was an undescribed species.
So let's just back up for a minute. The TVA is the Tennessee Valley Authority, and those folks make dams. Is that right?
Oh, they make dams big time.
Okay.
But they're just about out of the dam business because they've pretty much dammed up everything they can in the entire Tennessee Valley.
So now they're into maintenance of what they've got.
Right.
Right. So the snail darter eats. This is a fish that's how big is it?
It's always been jokingly referred to as a 3-inch fish. It doesn't get much bigger than that. It's 3.5 inches.
So briefly, can you tell me how a fish can eat a snail?
Well, they eat very small snails.
Oh, okay.
There's a group of snails that don't get much bigger than a millimeter in length.
Wow. Okay.
And maybe a millimeter and a half, 2 millimeters would be a giant. But yeah, that's what they're out there. And they may take an aquatic insect occasionally, but it's primarily snails.
And so when I think of a fish that eats a snail, you don't just need the fish, you need the snail in the habitat.
Correct.
Okay. Because you got to have food to have a species.
And it's fairly, the snail was fairly widespread and common, so it was not one that was endangered. So the food source was there.
Okay.
And the Tennessee Basin had been fairly well sampled over the years.
Okay.
But it had also been highly altered over the years, and a lot of the alteration took place prior to a lot of the sampling that took place in the rivers. The exception to that was TVA, actually, in the 1930s, when they started building some of these dams, they realized that they were probably endangering some fishes, but there was no law, there was no requirement that they stop and look at anything in the 1930s and
40s. Right.
But they did invite some ichthyologists from the University of Michigan to come down and sample, and they came down and they collected tons of fish and took them back to Michigan.
Okay.
And they sorted a lot of them out, but a lot of them sat unsorted in the Michigan collection for decades. But it turns out when they did go through those, there were no snail darters there, so they didn't collect any. But that may have been because of the way they were sampling. You pretty much have to have a seine, a minnow seine, that's basically used for catching bait and things like that. And you go out and you set that in gravel shoals, and you get above the net, and you have people kick the, stir up the bottom and kick the gravel around, and that chases the darters into the net. And that's the way they found the snail darter.
So if they were using a net with, say, a quarter-inch hole, like a gill net
They would have missed it.
They'd have gone right through there. Huh. Did they describe their sampling techniques and what they'd used?
They didn't.
Okay.
Well, we know that some of them was rotenone samples, which is a fixed fish toxicant. And they just put the rotenone in, and whatever came up, they picked it up with nets. But when you're dipping up fish from rotenone samples, you don't always get the smaller species.
Oh, interesting. You lose them there too, huh?
Okay. Especially darters, because they're more down on the bottom, and they just roll over and die.
And they stay there.
So that left them out.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay.
I knew Dr. Betty Vetnier, E-T-N-I-E-R, who's the ichthyologist at the University of Tennessee. I knew him well. And also knew his grad student, who's now Dr. Wayne Starnes, S-T-A-R-N-E-S. And Wayne at the time was a grad student that found it. And Dave and Wayne were immediately looking at it, saying, we haven't seen this one before, and started basically looking at it in terms of describing it as a new species. And I was totally connected to Wayne and Dave basically by phone on a pretty regular basis there, working on this thing. Because I knew it was going to come to me eventually.
Mm.
I was going to have to deal with it, so I wanted to stay on top of it, and which I did. And basically, they submitted the petition. And first, TVA said, well, you can't list it because it doesn't have a scientific name and hasn't been described yet. So Wayne and Dave got busy and got the thing described. It went through a peer review process. It was published as a valid species. So about that time, we get the petition to list it, and because I told, by this time, there was a lawyer that had joined the effort down there, and he was teaching at University of Tennessee Law School. His name was Zyg Plater, P-L-A-T-E-R, and so he was in touch with me, and I just basically told Zyg that there's probably no way that we're going to get this through without being petitioned to do it, or that would at least, you know, help bring it to the forefront.
Okay.
And so from there, we sure enough got a petition, and I started out basically looking at all the information they submitted, which was the biological data, including some life history data. They sent the description. So I had all that before me, and I started preparing a rulemaking. And so from there, we took off with a description and with a proposal to list it. And it... It really, I think, took a lot of people by surprise, and going to be a controversial case.
Why would it have taken people by surprise? You were doing your job.
Yeah, but I mean, they just didn't expect. I think the act hadn't been around that long, and to have that all of a sudden, basically. Bring up a real controversial thing in a 3-inch fish. I mean, what's going on here? It just, you know, no one was expecting that sort of a controversy that quickly after the act was passed, I guess.
Okay.
But that was in 70, so I found out about it in 74, and it was listed the next year, 75. And so TVA is still, you know, they're working on the dam. And all the time it's going back and forth. Well, why are you working on this dam? Because you're going to wipe out this fish. And I forget the exact dates in there, but we went ahead and designated the area's critical habitat. Because under the Endangered Species Act, it's kind of like there are two things there. You can make a case against somebody for taking the species, that is direct, you know, removed from the water take. And that includes harming, harassing, and disturbing it. Or you can destroy its habitat. That's a whole other critical habitat. It's a whole other way of getting the act to come into to force against a particular action. So this way we had both bases covered, so to speak. There was a take involved because you're directly impacting the fish and you're destroying its critical habitat. So with that, things rock along, and it gets the suit was filed and went to court, and we won, and basically it got appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, and it won there.
Wow, okay.
That, I think, really shocked people. And it was only when, this was during the Carter administration, when there was basically a budget bill that was in Congress, and they could see this confrontation coming. And so what the, I think it was Senator Baker from Tennessee, slipped into the budget bill at, you know, the middle of the night, basically an amendment that said the Tellico Dam project in Tennessee is exempt from all federal laws and regulations.
Oh.
Yeah. And that got passed. And so all of a sudden, there's no enforcement of the Endangered Species Act because basically that the whole project is exempt from any federal laws and regulations. And
those budget bills are typically 1 year bills, and so anything right. that you put in there lasts for a year, but still that could be, you know, a year could be enough for a dam to destroy a species.
Well, I think the way this was worded, though, they said basically that this project is exempt from any federal laws and regulations. Yeah.
Okay.
And that brought up all sorts of questions about, well, what about health and safety issues? You know, did that get thrown out the window too?
Like OSHA?
Yeah,
okay.
It got them all in one fell swoop.
Wow.
But so we, from there, they started basically picking up, TVA did, started collecting the fish and we're moving them out of the way, reintroducing them into other rivers to save them, and they put them in some nearby rivers in the Tennessee Basin, which was probably at one time home to this fish anyway, so they weren't really putting them way outside the range. We estimated basically what the range was, and it was pretty widespread probably because it's what we call a big river fish, which means it lives in large streams, which is one reason it hadn't been detected prior to that. So it was probably throughout the Tennessee Basin, at least in the area from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, which is where it leaves the rocky portion of the river and gets down to the coastal plain, which is basically all sand and gravel. So it was pretty widespread probably at one time. And so they introduced it around, and so with that, they, in 1979, they closed the dam. And was a controversial project all the way around because they basically took land from landowners that had been there for several generations.
Oh, wow.
Farming the land. It was the namesake of the state of Tennessee because the Cherokee settlement of Tanassee, T-A-N-S-I, and that was basically T-A-N-A-S-I, Tanassee, yeah. And so they were covering up the namesake of the state of Tennessee when they built this thing. And there were all sorts of people that just said, no, don't do this. And there was a lot of stream fishing, and they wanted to keep that around because there's not very much of it left because of all the dams that have been built. And but it so it goes along, and after a few years, some of the introduced populations were successful, and eventually it got to the point where it was downlisted from endangered to threatened because they had established two or three new populations. Okay. And but between 1974, when I got there, and 1979, 1980, it was hardly a week that went by that I didn't have snail darter popping up somewhere on my desk, some way or another. But the good news is it was just petitioned to be delisted the other day, and that was done by. Remember, I mentioned the lawyer at the University of Tennessee, Zig Plotter,
yeah,
who petitioned the service to list it. Well, he, along with myself and along with the Center for Biological Diversity, were the three individuals, or two individuals in the group, that petitioned the service to delist it because it had recovered.
Okay.
And part of the reason, part of the reason we petitioned was that we knew from several different state and federal agencies that these things were being picked up now in a lot of these streams in the Tennessee Valley. And so we wanted to get it delisted because we wanted to advertise the fact that the Endangered Species Act works.
Right.
And I forgot to mention there, one of the things that TVA did in the process of trying to get this thing recovered, get off the list, which Fish and Wildlife Service basically held their feet to the fire on, which is through the consultation process, is they got them to pump flows through the dams. And what that does, it keeps a little bit of water flowing past the dam during times when they're not generating.
Okay.
So that enabled the fish to basically populate areas below dams that they were either never, well, they weren't there because of the dam and the flows were not right, or if they were there, they were in small patches of habitat and just had not been detected. And
so
we don't know which one of those is.
When I think of pulse flow, I think of in-stream rights, which is a different term where you're going to keep a base load of water, a certain amount of flow in a river to keep the habitat alive. But but it sounds like a pulse flow doesn't quite work that way. Instead of letting out a constant low flow, it pulses, lets out a bunch, and then waits, and then lets out a bunch, and then waits. Which seems like an odd way to do it.
Yeah. To be honest with you, I'm not sure exactly how frequent those pulses are, but it's enough to keep whatever suspended material is in the water column below the dams from settling out.
Okay.
But they generate a lot of the power they use in those hydro projects in the Tennessee Valleys for basically for peaking power, some of it is.
Right.
So, you know, early morning when people are getting up, getting showers and getting ready to go to work, cooking, and then they need power and they need it in a hurry, so they turn on the switch and flood the, or start the turbines, and they generate power immediately and they're online. And the same thing in the afternoon or evening when people come home from work. So, and there might be times on the weekend where, you know, they don't generate as much. They may hold back water, and depending on what the need is in the basin, but they sell power, TVA does, all over the southeast, but they're part of the network. But it's basically changes like that, and there was one dam on a tributary river where they put snow larders, the Elk River, where they basically shut the turbines off for several months during the late spring and early summer when they need the temperature in the stream to be more natural, warmer than it is ordinarily because they're pulling water off the bottom of the dam. It's cold, and a lot of fish just didn't reproduce in there.
Hmm.
And sure enough, when you turn the water off for a couple, 3 months in the late spring, summer, boy, that water warms up down there, and all of a sudden, and they're spilling water, but they're spilling it off the top. There's not generating power with.
Okay.
But what that does is give you stream temperatures that make it suitable for fish to spawn in, and that's that basically created a good population in the Elk River now. So, all in all, it's a success story, both from the standpoint of the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. And again, there was a town, I think it was Telco Plains on the Telco River, which drains into the Little Tennessee River, which is the original place they inhabited, that was a fairly large stream, and there were a couple of point source pollution problems around there that didn't get cleaned up until the Clean Water Act was passed in the 70s. And now there's snail darters up there. So,
okay.
Clean Water Act, though, is I think, one of the unsung heroes in certainly in the southeastern United States, because water pollution, I can personally testify, was awful in the southeastern United States in the 1960s.
Okay.
It was criminal. But, you know, it was, you have stuff going in the river out of a foundry or out of a creosote plant where they put creosote, make creosote posts and things. And, you know, people see it in the river and it's killing things. It looks like jobs to me, you know. It's all about, you can't disturb the industry because that's where people make their living. So just never mind, you know. It's okay. And
so that
Clean Water Act changed a lot of that.
That legislation that was put in by that Tennessee congressman to exclude the Telco Dam from all federal legislation, did that ever get repealed with anything else, or is that still the case?
I don't know the answer to that. I'll have to ask my friend Jig Plotter. But it's certainly, yes, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I
mean, that's a bold move.
They probably figured out a way to get around it, but I don't know what it is.
Hmm. Okay. I mean, that just sounds, you know, why have regulations when a congressman is going to say, well, we're just going to bypass all that? You know, it doesn't kind of make sense. Okay. Well, so that sounds like
that was definitely the most controversial case we had, or I had.
And ended in success.
And, pardon?
And it ended in success in the end.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. It took 45 years.
Okay,
but, hey, the fact is, we have one fish that's no longer needing the protection from the Endangered Species List, and some people have said, well, how do you know these pulse flows are going to continue? And TVA is committed to that by way of the Fish and Wildlife Service, who they continue to monitor that. And the other thing that's happened that they were so successful with these pulse flows and changes in water conditions below dams that they basically got a bunch of freshwater mussels moving in that are also on the endangered species list. So they're still endangered species in the same habitat where the snail turtle was, basically.
Okay.
So it's safe. I feel I would not have petitioned the service to take it off the list if I didn't feel comfortable doing that. So
let's kind of switch to the Colorado River, because the humpback chub is listed. Did that listing come across your desk while you were in the endangered species office? Or was that later?
I think that one was, let me think. Boy, I'm trying to remember. That would be, I should have looked that up earlier. I think that was one that I listed. It was either that or it was already on the list. It may have been on the list already.
Okay.
You know, if you recall, when the 1973 Act was passed, Congress just said, we don't take all these things that are already on the Fish and Wildlife Service list and move those forward, and they're immediately listed. Bam.
Hmm.
So that, in one fell swoop, they took everything that was in the Fish and Wildlife Service Red Books and moved that forward, which is how a bunch of the subspecies of trouts on there is endangered. That were not really endangered, but they were threatened, and that's the ones that I had. That was one of my first jobs to download those three western trout. So.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, that.
Because I'm thinking about
the
bony tail. There was a number of native fish to the Colorado. The pike minnow, which could grow up to six feet long.
About that, five feet, yeah.
Large fish for a minnow.
And
all of those would have been, people would have been seeing those fish populations crash. Well, after Hoover Dam, I remember reading somewhere that one of the people that worked at Lee's Ferry in the 20s, noticed that when Hoover Dam came in, the pike minnow populations dropped, because those fish were like salmon. They would go out to the sea and then they would come back up again.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no fish ladder there today, that's for sure. And there was none then. So
yeah. as I said, the more I think about it, I'm trying to remember back on my workload, what I did when. I think all of those Colorado River fishes were already on the list when the 73 Act was passed.
Okay.
So they were given immediate protection in 1973 as endangered species. But what I do recall this very vividly, was to work on their critical habitat.
Okay.
And that was one that did get a little bit sensitive, in that we basically were proposing large chunks of the green in Colorado rivers and some of the tributaries, and that really caught the attention of a lot of people. But it was one of those things where we I think had enough evidence of the things either occurring there or requiring that habitat that we got it through, I guess, basically in a nutshell. And I forget how many hundreds of miles of critical habitat we had in the Colorado Basin for those fishes, but it was a fair amount, and I think really the fact that I haven't kept up with that, but I know that they've tried reintroducing it in places where critical habitat was determined, and
right.
that way, because at that point, that's one of the changes over time in the way the Act's administered. A lot of the habitat that I proposed for listing did not currently have populations of fishes, those humpback chub, bony-tailed chub, and razorback cyclone squawfish. It didn't have those in, you know, there reproducing. If they had, you wouldn't need to have listed the fish.
Right.
But what it was, we were looking at areas that we need to improve habitat, try to recover, so we could put populations back in there if we did captive propagation work and so forth. So that was one of the ideas that we had in mind when we started thinking about basically looking at critical habitat for these things.
Okay.
So
how was it that you ended up on a Grand Canyon River trip looking at fish?
Well, we had one of the nice things about my job was basically the director of Fish and Wildlife Service and people who ran the office were very supportive of biologists going out and getting firsthand information rather than just taking it all out of published literature or agency reports or talking to agency biologists.
Okay.
So I would go out each year when I would go to Desert Fishes Council meetings, which were always in November, and usually late November, a week or so before Thanksgiving. And I would go a week to 10 days early, and I would meet up with a Fish and Wildlife Service biologist, and we'd basically take off, and I'd start looking at habitat of all these desert fishes, and you know, whether it's wound fin in the Virgin River, and or some spring thing that occurred only in the Pluvial White River in southern Nevada.
Okay.
Basically, I wanted to see the habitat before I start writing about it to say, and I was taking pictures at the same time I'm doing all this. And
cool.
I kept looking at the Colorado River and thinking, how the hell am I going to get on the Colorado River? And I knew at the time that some of the people in the Utah and Arizona state agencies were saying, well, there's supposed to be some left in the Grand Canyon, you know, and we believe they're humpback chubs. That's where it was first discovered. The first collections and the ones used in the original description were from the Grand Canyon, but that was before the Grand Canyon Dam went in.
Right.
So, anyway, I did get a trip on the Green River from Jensen, Utah, down to Ouray, and that was a float trip, and on that trip, we did get squawfish, and we did get razorback suckers, but we didn't get any chubs.
Okay, hang on a second. So what year would have that been? And Jensen is just not too terribly far downstream from Dinosaur National Monument's Split Mountain and Lador and Whirlpool Canyon and all those water sections up there. The river comes out into the flat Uinta Basin and picks up Jensen, and it goes for 100 and some miles before it hits the next mountain range down in Desolation and Gray Canyons.
Yeah.
That's flat water country, but there's a wildlife sanctuary in there, and it's really pretty country if you like wildlife.
Oh, it was absolutely gorgeous. I mean, we started, I think that trip, I don't recall how many river miles that was covered, but we're not out on a race either. We were basically picking sites that look to be good habitat.
Okay.
You know, you might have a shoal area that, let's try this. And over here is a little pool area, backwater area, let's try that.
Okay.
And here's a little tributary coming in over here. And we were getting things like, oh, I recognize that from back home, that's a largemouth bass, and that's a spotted bass, and that's a, oh, look, there's a channel catfish and a bullhead. And it was like, it's distressing. It's like, good Lord, these things shouldn't be in here, but they're all over the, as you know, they're all over the entire basin. But that reach from Jensen down to Oray was my first experience on the Green River, and I just could not believe the absolute beauty of that river there. I kind of just loved it. And then there was, another trip that I spent some time on the Yampa, but that was more at basically going to road crossings and maybe taking a canoe and basically going upriver a little bit to look at some habitat and downriver a little bit, but nothing overnight like they did on the Green River.
Okay.
And we spent two nights on the Green River.
Do you remember who else was with you on that Green River Jensen to Oray trip and what year that might have been?
Boy, I was trying to think. It was a bunch of Fish and Wildlife Service people. The one guy I do remember was Jim Johnson. Jim Johnson was a Fish and Wildlife Service employee. Or he may have been, Jim worked for BLM for a while and then moved over to Fish and Wildlife Service. And he may have been BLM at the time. But he was heavily involved in Colorado River Fish work there for a while.
Okay.
And Paul Holden might have been on that trip. He was with BioWest.
H-O-L-D-E-N?
Consulting. Pardon?
How do you spell Paul's last name?
Holden, H-O-L-D-E-N.
Thank you.
Yeah, he's, I think he's still, I know the company BioWest is still around. I think he's still actively involved in it.
Okay.
He might be a couple years younger than I am, so, but.
And so they would have been a contractor working for the service to study the fish?
Right.
Okay.
Right, right. He had, from time to time, contracts with Reclamation, BLM, and Fish and Wildlife Service to look at different aspects. You know, are there any fish here? There might have been a project going in that he was trying to assess the potential impact if they're there.
Okay.
That was my first real experience on in the Colorado River system on a large river. I'd been on the Virgin River, but again, that's just going to places that you can access the river and get in and seine for a wound fin and see what's there. But that's, you know, the Virgin River is it's like a large creek compared to the Colorado River and Green River.
Right.
God, I just couldn't get over the beauty of the Green River. That is just unreal. And part of that, we were, at the same time we're getting the squawfish and the razorback, it's like, you know, there's also some trout in there. We were boat shopping, and we may have set some gill nets at night, or did we? I don't think we did, because I think we're worried about if we got a bunch of squawfish in there and they died, that would be bad.
Yeah.
So, most of it was boat shopping. Oh, I know what we did. We did set some hoop nets near the mouth of some of the creeks just to see what was moving in and out of the creeks.
Okay.
One of the creeks, anyway. I forget which one. And we did, that night, when we put that in, we ran it, and then we ran it. I think somebody got in the middle of the night just to check to see if it was all right. Didn't get much out of it, basically. That's what it amounted to.
Okay.
But,
hey, Jim.
We were already thinking, yes.
Can you explain how you shock a fish and what that does and how it works?
Basically, you've got a small generator in the boat, and you've got a, what we call a brain box, for lack of a better name for it. But it's basically where you're regulating the current. So you can basically increase, decrease the amount of current. And that's usually based on the conductivity in the water.
Okay.
So if you're in something that's got a lot of mineral content in it, that's going to be have a that's going to conduct electricity a lot better than something that sends less mineralized water, then you basically want to use different current settings. Hmm. And so that's and basically what you're doing is you've got these two big booms that stick out the front of the boat, and they usually have some cable sticking down in the water, and the electricity passes through those, and anything comes within the range of current around those gets shocked. And basically, it's no different than shocking a mammal or a human. It stuns them, and that's what you, if you get good at it, which the guys running our boats there in the Green River were good at it, you can stun a fish with it without killing them. Hmm. And so that's what we were doing, basically. Okay. And those were being tagged, as I recall, too. I think we're putting tags on them so we could, if you got caught a year later, 2 years, 5 years later, you'd know when this fish was tagged and where it was when it was tagged and how big it was and that sort of thing. So it was one of those kinds of operations. And,
so I wonder, I'm thinking about a generator. This was probably a direct current, not alternating current, is my assumption.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, a boat, water, a generator, electricity. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a great way to shock yourself.
Yeah. What you don't want to do when you start handling fish in the boat and you get your hands all slimy and you stick your hand over the side of the boat and get shocked. I've done that once or twice.
Hmm.
It's just, you just automatically you get your hands all messy and you need to write some notes and you stick your hand over and it's like, oops, oh, that hurt.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing you only do once or twice.
It's a good sting. It doesn't knock you out or anything.
Okay.
But, and there's a lot of tricks to the trade and shocking fish in terms of the amount of power you use, the settings, and that I know nothing about because I've never run one of the brain boxes.
Hmm.
I've always been fortunate enough to have great technicians working with me that knew a lot more about it than I did. So that was their job.
Okay.
I didn't mess with it. But, the little bit of work I did on the Yampa and then the float trip on the Green, that was my first introduction to it. And I had spent some time down below Hoover Dam on the river down there, and basically we were looking at there was a place where there was razorback suckers in one of the reservoirs below the Hoover Dam downstream, and Wendell Minkley, the professor ichthyologist at Arizona State, discovered this, and we went down there to see what was going on, and we wound up spending a couple nights down there. And of course, it's just a big reservoir in the desert downstream of Hoover. I forget the name of the reservoir we're on down there, but
is that Parker?
Basically, I'm sorry.
I was just thinking maybe it was Parker. There's a number of reservoirs down here.
It may have been Parker. It may have been Parker. Because another fish, some of the fish we collected wound up going to Parker. But what they were doing there, basically the fish was spawning on some of the point bars out in the reservoirs, the suckers were.
Wow.
And their eggs were viable and they were hatching and things were just great. And it's like, well, why isn't the reservoir full of these things? And basically the reason was the fry were being eaten by catfish, bass, and all the other introduced eastern fishes that preyed on.
Got it.
So
it's amazing that they actually were able to survive in the reservoir.
Well, that was the thing that shocked all of us, frankly, until Minkley found them there, and he said, these things are spawning in the reservoir. It's like, what? And there's a small population there. It's not one that it's not huge, but if you get there, he had it. By the time I got there, he had it down to the week in terms of water temperature and timing when they're going to be spawning out here. If we set nets tonight, we'll get them.
Wow.
And we did. And as I said, some of those went to the Fish and Wildlife Service hatchery at Parker, and they were spawning them in raceways up there. So, so those were kind of my experiences. And then in 1976, which basically was pretty early on, I'd only been in the Endangered Species Office since 74, so second year in.
Right.
And there was an opportunity through the contract that Park Service had given to Tulane University, and the Fish and Wildlife Service was kind of co-managing this contract, and basically called for a number of float trips down the Colorado River to assess the status of not just fish, but also reptiles, amphibians, and small mammals.
Okay.
So that was the, and I knew the people at Tulane. I knew the people in the Fish and Wildlife Lab. And when I heard about it, I said, wow, I'd really like to go on that, because at some point I'm going to be doing critical habitat for these things. And it'd be great to have that experience behind my belt, to go from basically below Glen Canyon Dam all the way down to backwaters of Hoover Dam. And that was a trip.
Okay. So all those dams came in on the Colorado River, Flaming Gorge, on Navajo, the dams on the Gunnison, Kiraconte, Glen Canyon, and Hoover Dam. All those dams on that water basin, the Colorado River basin, is about what, 1,400 miles, something like that. I'm just guessing. And it seems as though that the fish, some of the fish species, were able to actually survive being trapped between dams.
Yeah. And what you get in a lot of reservoir situations is a case where you have a dam that backs up water, and when you get to the upper end of the reservoir, there's frequently a short stretch of riverine-like habitat
right. That's
left, and
between the next dam, yeah, upstream.
Right.
Got it.
Right. And that's basically what goes on with Glen Canyon Dam, which you've got the whole canyon basically that, and that was one of the things that was pointed out to us as we're going down the canyon was, I guess he's one of the boatmen, one of the Park Service boatmen, that said, hey, let's see those holes up there in the side of the canyon? And yeah, well, that's where they came in and drilled to get rock samples to look at another possible dam that would have been one or two dams in the Grand Canyon.
That's right.
So there were drill holes in the walls of the canyon that they wanted to dam up the entire Grand Canyon. It's like,
right. What
were they thinking?
Yeah, yeah.
And, that just blew me away. It's like, God, I can't believe it. And I think it was Barry Goldwater said at one point that if he had one vote that he could take back, that he cast his entire career in the United States Senate, he would take back the vote he cast in favor of Glen Canyon Dam.
Yeah.
I remember reading that somewhere along the way, and that always impressed me. It's like he knew after Glen Canyon that, wow, we probably shouldn't have done that, you know?
It's funny. I've been going through that history, and at the time, he was all for it. But we change, and we get a better view and a bigger, better understanding, and we realize we've made some mistakes, and that's understandable.
Yeah. And that's really, I think when they put in Hoover Dam, that was really, that changed the region. I mean, it brought water and power to an area that was pretty desolate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but Glen Canyon, what did that bring?
Right.
I mean, it's a dam and a reservoir in the middle of the desert. And wow. But the fact that even after they built those two, they still had drill holes in the wall of the Grand Canyon where they were thinking about putting in, I don't know if it was one or two, but I think I said two, or maybe it was just two, three different drill sites.
At least two.
For one dam.
One at Bridge Canyon,
okay.
way at the lower end of Grand Canyon, and the other at Marble Canyon, the Marble Canyon dam site. There was a third dam site that got a little bit of attention from the Arizona Power Authority called the Prospect Dam, which was down below Lava Falls, but that never took off. Didn't receive as much interest as Reclamation had in Bridge Canyon. But yeah, by that time, you know, those dams were in there. And it was, you know, just sort of like the TVA. I mean, the dams were in there, and the habitat was an afterthought.
Yeah. And all that took place, unfortunately, at a time when we didn't really understand, or there was no concern for what we were doing in terms of, you know, what's going to be left here when we dam up all of our rivers.
Right, that's right.
Which is what's happened with PDA. Again, the Endangered Species Act, which is a quick example, backing up a little bit, they had a dam on the Duck River, which is one of the last undammed rivers in the entire TVA system. And they had started building a dam, and they had the concrete structure finished, and the water was running through it, the base of it, they hadn't closed it up yet. And they had built the dirt portion of the dam, which is basically to the side off to the floodplain. And because of the controversy over the snail darter, and there are a bunch of endangered mussels in the Duck River, they decided to stop. They didn't build it. So the endangered, I frequently tell people that, you know, we lost the battle for the snail darter, but we won the war in that they built Tellico Dam, but they didn't build the dam, one or two that they're looking at on the Duck River.
Okay.
And by the way, that one that they built, that the concrete was there, about 20 years ago, I guess it was, they went in and tore it all out.
Okay.
They took it down.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, it never backed water up. It was always like a water supply. Not that it was needed, but all those dams that TVA built, they were, a lot of those had to do with, some of them had to do with flood control, but a lot of them were real estate projects too. They're on a waterfront property and development on waterfront property. And that was certainly true with the one on the Little Tee. But I look at things like, you know, on the Colorado River, it's like, Lake Mead, there are no large towns around there, so if you don't have a place on Lake Mead, you'd have to go a long way, and there's not a lot of places to build on Lake Mead. I mean, it's pretty steep country around there. But, I mean, Page is the largest community, I guess, around the dam site there, and that's I don't know what the population of Page, Arizona is, but it's not big.
Right. I mean, for Lake Mead, down by Hoover Dam, you've got Las Vegas, but for Lake Powell up at Grand Canyon, you know, it's a recreational area for houseboats and other pleasure craft. And, you know, that nowadays the Canyoneers are out there and there's people out in the landscape. But if that reservoir hadn't been there, it would have been, it already was being overrun by tourists on the river by the early 1960s with, you know, 100 people a day walking from the river up to Rainbow Bridge. You know, it was getting very, very popular. So that, you know, that anyway, I digress. But again, the people seeing the growth of Phoenix and Tucson that wanted some of the lower basin share needed well, they didn't need, but they wanted to do that through the Central Arizona Project, was mm-hmm. calling forth on these dams in the 60s, which would have been Marble and Bridge. But by this time, you know, again,
and Marble's not that far below, it's the upper one, so it's,
that's right,
it's just below Meade and or Glen Canyon, and it's like, why would you, I mean, that's, yeah, it's crazy.
Right. Well, 50 or 60 miles below Glen, and the concept, yeah, the concept was, we're going to tunnel from there to the Salt River drainage and dump water in the Salt so it can flow to Phoenix. That was an early concept.
Oh.
The other was to drill over to the Kanab Creek drainage and have a powerhouse there where you would make hydroelectricity and just bypass mm-hmm. the Grand Canyon. And then that water would run immediately into the reservoir for Bridge Canyon, the next dam downstream. So you basically stair-step the whole deal, and you run the water around Grand Canyon National mm-hmm. Park instead of through it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I remember we fought over in the Endangered Species Office, and again, it was one of those things that the Central Arizona Project, it's like, that's moving water around, and that's just not going to be a good idea, because you're going to have exotics in that are going to be dispersed everywhere through that system.
Oh, interesting.
And, pardon?
Interesting.
Yeah, and also just the fact that it's going to take water away from some place where you may really want that water for fishes or
right.
For other organisms. So it was one of those things that we were constantly battling. It seems like water projects. Well, if you work with fish, that's pretty much is your job.
Right, yeah, which is interesting, because I think of the Sea of Cortez, the Colorado River Delta, which was a robust environmental community of all sorts of species, and now it's it's just been decimated.
That was one the Totoaba, which was a big fish that used to run up the Colorado River and at least hang out in the estuary, and then when you dry up the river so that, you know, below Yuma there's very little flow, and
right.
By the time it crosses the border, the salinity gets so high in the lower part of the Colorado River, it actually goes from low out in the Gulf of California, as you go up the river, the salinity was actually increasing.
Wow, wow.
And so that was one of the threats. And of course, in the Salton Sea was another whole issue there. But
right.
I guess that now is pretty much dry totally.
That I don't know. I don't know, but it's ready to fill again. And that you know, makes me think about flooding on the Colorado River,
mm-hmm.
And if we lose any of these dams upstream due to paleo flooding, which can happen again,
mm-hmm.
The Salton Sea mm-hmm. will fill.
So
you know, kind of look at these systems and ponder how we have managed them to not work.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a very curious.
Well, it was the jumping off place for us was there below Glen Canyon Dam and mouth of Paria River.
Right, place and, called Lee's Ferry.
Yep, and it was I had I guess I, well I'd done a bunch of backpacking in the West. I'd done some camping and. But I thought, this is going to be, and my friend, Glenn Summer, who had been down on a couple of other trips before me, and went on a number of them after me, he said, oh, it's just, you know, it's just like backpack camping and all, but it's only in the canyon. And it was like, I was not prepared for it, but I was and, you know, in terms of equipment and what I was wearing, I knew it was going to be pretty rough and whatever. But when it wasn't, the heat in the canyon was like, wow. I thought I was acclimated to the heat from being a native southerner and southeasterner, but that was searing hot.
Hey, Jim, a couple questions for you. How do you spell Glenn Clemmers? How do you spell Glenn's last name?
Oh, G-L-E-N-T-L-E-M-M-E-R.
And it sounds like you're leading into this river trip in Grand Canyon. Do you remember the rough dates of that trip?
Yes. We left on I think it was the 31st of May, 1976.
Oh, it'll be hot then. Okay.
And came out about 10 days later at Pierce Ferry.
Okay. So we've been talking for about an hour here. Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series. And honest, I guarantee, no, I better not say that. Next time we'll pick up this river trip, because I would like to know who was on it and how it came about that you got invited on it. You know, anything else you remember about that background? That would be great.
That'll work.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to add to the ground you've covered here before I wrap this up?
No.
Okay.
I think that pretty much covers it.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, then this will conclude part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Williams. Today is Thursday, September 9, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. And Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you.